Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Is celebrating our 25th anniversary. That's a quarter of a century of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear anywhere else. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now to make your contribution and help us stay on the air for at least another 25 years. Thank you so much. Oh, and remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Israeli aircraft shelled the whole street and the buildings and hit the infrastructure. Their aim is to destroy the economy and destroy the basic needs of the people. There is no clean water now, no sewage system, no services.
Nearly 200 Palestinians are now dead as Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip enters its second week. Over the weekend, Israel bombed a refugee camp, killing 10 members of an extended family. Another Israeli airstrike destroyed a high-rise building in Gaza City, which housed the offices of Al Jazeera, the Associated Press, and other media. With the backing of the United States, Israel's refused international calls to stop its assault, which has already left 40,000 Palestinians homeless. We'll go to Gaza for the latest.
Yesterday, Israel destroyed whole blocks, killing over 40 people. Whole families were annihilated by the Israeli war machine.
We'll also talk to the head of the leading Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, which has accused Israel of committing war crimes in Gaza by targeting civilians and destroying infrastructure on a massive scale. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our viewers, the story contains graphic images of violence and death. Israel's assault on Gaza has entered its second week with air raids pounding the besieged territory overnight. Sunday marked the deadliest day so far, with at least 42 people killed. The Palestinian death toll has reached nearly 200, more than a quarter of those children. Over 1,300 have been wounded. 40,000 Gazans have lost their homes. Gatherings for Eid al-Fitr, the end of Ramadan, over the weekend turned into a tragedy for some families.
They targeted the house they were in. There were no rockets there, just women and children. No rockets, just peaceful children celebrating Eid. What have they done to deserve this? A rocket hit their house, over their heads, without warning or communication. Three whole floors fell over them, and we had to recover their body parts.
The executive editor of the Associated Press is calling for an independent investigation after Israeli strikes flattened the building in Gaza City Saturday, which housed media offices of Al Jazeera, AP, and other media, but which Israel said also housed members of Hamas. Rights groups are asking the International Criminal Court to investigate the likely war crime. The Israeli army also is targeting underground tunnels they say are used by Hamas. Rockets fired into Israel have killed at least 10 civilians. One Israeli soldier has also been killed. As the UN and others are calling for an immediate ceasefire, massive protests took place around the globe this weekend, including in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, in East Jerusalem's Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, where Palestinian families are fighting Israeli attempts to evict them from their homes. Protesters marked al-Nakba, what they call the 1948 expulsion of nearly 800,000 Palestinians from their homes.
There is another wall where they will draw Palestine's map, and inside of it is Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, where from it the fire started in all of Palestine. Today, on Nakba's 73rd anniversary, we do not want to say that Nakba is still ongoing, but we want to say today, in Nakba's anniversary, that it is time for the Nakba to stop. After this popular outburst, after this revolution that Palestine is going through from sea to river.
After headlines, we'll go to Gaza for the latest and spend the rest of the hour on the crisis. India is approaching 25 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, with another 4,000 deaths recorded over the past day, though experts say the true toll is far higher. In neighboring Nepal, COVID-19 cases continue to surge, overwhelming hospitals, which are having to turn away patients due to a lack of oxygen. Thousands of migrant workers returned home to Nepal following lockdowns in India. The government has imposed a nationwide shutdown in Nepal, banned international flights, and limited public gatherings. Nepal's prime minister lost a parliamentary vote of confidence last week. He's been forced to step down amidst growing public anger over his response to the second COVID wave. In Taiwan, officials have imposed its strictest measures yet, limiting gatherings and shutting down entertainment venues to combat a spike in COVID cases. Singapore is moving all schools to at-home learning. Thailand reported its highest ever daily toll today at nearly 10,000 infections, with over two-thirds of those cases recorded among prisoners. Here in the United States, a number of retail and entertainment businesses are doing away with mask requirements following new guidance issued by the Centers for Disease Control last week. Walmart, Costco, Trader Joe's, Publix, and Starbucks are some of the chains that will no longer require fully vaccinated customers that wear masks. The largest U.S. nurses union, National Nurses United, blasted the new CDC recommendations, saying they put health workers and others at increased risk. In housing news, the federal judge who threw out the national eviction moratorium earlier this month issued a stay of her own decision Friday, allowing the moratorium to continue while the Justice Department appeals her ruling. Lawmakers and the Biden administration have moved to extend the eviction ban, which is set to expire at the end of June. In Afghanistan, a bomb blast inside a mosque in the capital, Kabul, killed at least 12 people Friday as worshippers were gathered for the Eid al-Fitr holiday ending Ramadan. The massacre, claimed by the Islamic State, came despite a three-day ceasefire for the religious holiday. This is a witness to the explosion.
The whole nation is witnessing this situation. It is the same all over Afghanistan, not only here. These traitors, the government officials, do not pursue these incidents at all. How long should the situation be like this? If they cannot govern, then they must step down.
Meanwhile, fighting between the Taliban and government forces continues to escalate in southern Helmand province as the U.S. troop withdrawal continues. In Chile, voters have elected 155 delegates charged with drafting a new constitution to replace the current document, which was created under the U.S.-backed dictator Augusto Pinochet. By law, half the delegates must be women. Independent candidates receive the highest number of votes, dealing a blow to the center-right ruling coalition and increasing the chances the new constitution will contain major reforms. This comes a year and a half after mass protests rocked Chile with demands for expanded access to education, indigenous sovereignty, a reversal to growing social and economic inequalities, and an end to police brutality. In Colombia, at least one person was killed and dozens more injured in the city of Popayan on Friday as police battled protesters demanding an end to police brutality. The demonstration followed the suicide of a 17-year-old girl after she was sexually abused by police officers. On Saturday, a massive protest march flooded the streets of Colombia's capital, Bogota, as nationwide anti-government demonstrations entered their third week. The protests were sparked by a since-withdrawn tax reform and are also calling for an end to militarized policing and other reforms.
We have a clear agenda from the streets. A police reform for the health plots to be done away with. How does the government respond? Raping our sisters, killing us. And this is a clear example of social discontent. This is no longer about political parties. People are tired of being killed, of killing us. That's why we're here today.
Back back in the United States, House Republicans have elected New York Congressmember Elise Stefanik as their new conference chair. This comes 2 days after Republicans ousted Wyoming Congressmember Liz Cheney from the leadership role after she voted to impeach former President Trump for inciting the deadly January 6th Capitol insurrection. Stefanik is a Trump loyalist and has called him, quote, a critical part of our Republican team, unquote. On Friday, lawmakers set up a bipartisan commission to investigate the Capitol insurrection. Texas lawmakers have approved a bill that would ban all abortions about 6 weeks into a pregnancy while making anyone in Texas eligible to sue patients, medical workers, or even a patient's family or friends who, quote, aid and abet in an abortion. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is expected to sign the so-called fetal heartbeat bill, which will face immediate court challenges by Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union. In Ohio, the city of Columbus has reached a $10 million settlement with the family of Andre Hill, a 47-year-old black man who was shot and killed by a white police officer in December. The officer, Adam Coy, has been charged with murder. This is Andre Hill's daughter, Carissa Hill.
He died on a 311 call, non-emergency. He was shot four times. And after the four times, he was laying on the floor. There were 22 officers on scene. Nobody helped my father. The money is not even enough to help out the pain or anything with my dad laying on that floor.
In the wake of Andre Hill's killing, the Columbus City Council also passed Andre's law, mandating the use of body cameras and requiring police officers to give and call for aid if they cause any injuries. The mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and a state senator representing the city have apologized for the massacre of students at Jackson State College 51 years ago. On May 15, 1970, local and state police opened fire on a group of students at the predominantly black college, shooting hundreds of rounds in a 28-second barrage. Two were killed, a dozen injured. On Saturday, Jackson Mayor Shoko Antar Lumumba and State Senator Hillman Frazier formally apologized at a special commencement ceremony for members of the class of 1970. And Philadelphia's mayor says the city has now located the partial remains of victims of the 1985 police bombing of the home of the radical black liberation anti-police brutality group MOVE. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney's announcement came just one day after he forced Philadelphia Health Commissioner Thomas Farley to resign, after Farley revealed he'd ordered the cremation of some of the bombing victims' remains in 2017 without the knowledge or consent of the families. But a subordinate of Farley's apparently disobeyed the order to dispose of the remains. The 1985 MOVE bombing killed six adults and five children and destroyed over 60 homes. For all of our interviews about the bombing and its aftermath, including the use of one or two of the dead children's remains by the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton University in courses teaching forensic anthropology, visit democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our viewers, today's show contains graphic images of violence and death. Israel's deadly assault on Gaza has entered its second week. On Sunday, Israel killed at least 42 Palestinians in Gaza in the deadliest day so far, as Israel bombarded the besieged area with airstrikes, artillery fire, and gunboat shelling. Over the past week, Israel's killed nearly 200 Palestinians, including 58 children and 34 women. Israel has also destroyed over 500 homes in Gaza, leaving 40,000 Palestinians homeless in Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli security forces and Jewish settlers killed at least 11 Palestinians in the West Bank Friday, in the deadliest day there since 2002. This comes as Hamas is continuing to fire rockets into Israel, where the death toll has reached 11, including two children. One Israeli airstrike on a Gaza refugee camp killed 10 members of the same extended family, including eight children. Israel's also leveled a 12-story building housing the offices of the Associated Press, Al Jazeera, and other media outlets on Saturday. Israel justified the bombing by claiming Hamas is using the building, but offered no proof. Earlier today, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken said he has not seen any Israeli evidence of Hamas operating in that building. The head of Al Jazeera called the attack a blatant violation of human rights and a war crime. Israeli strikes also damaged at least three hospitals in Gaza, as well as a clinic run by Doctors Without Borders. A number of doctors have also been killed in the Israeli airstrikes, including Dr. Ayman Abu Alouf. He headed the coronavirus response at Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest hospital. He and two of his teenage children died in an Israeli airstrike on their home. Another prominent doctor from the Shifa Hospital, the neurologist Muin Ahmad Al-Alul, was also killed in an airstrike on his home. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights said the Israeli airstrikes have erased entire residential neighborhoods and left earthquake-like destruction. On the diplomatic front, President Biden is facing growing criticism for refusing to call on Israel to halt its assault on Gaza. At the United Nations, the United States blocked the Security Council for the third time in a week from issuing a statement calling for a ceasefire following a virtual UN Security Council meeting on Sunday. Meanwhile, massive protests against the Israeli assault took place across the globe over the weekend, including Chicago, New York, Washington, London, Paris, Madrid, Doha, and Baghdad. We begin today's show in Gaza, where we're joined by Rafat Alarir, Palestinian academic and activist who's the editor of the book Gaza Writes Back and the co-editor of Gaza Unsilenced. Also with us is Matthias Schmala, director of operations in Gaza for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, known as UNRWA. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Rafat Alarir, can you describe the situation on the ground right now in Gaza?
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Democracy Now! You've just mentioned this. This is an earthquake-level kind of destruction, reminiscent of the tsunami that happened in Japan almost a decade ago, and gives us sparks of the blitz in the 40s. Now, what Israel is doing is total devastation and destruction to Palestinian homes, Palestinian infrastructure, the roads, the access to water, sewage. Today, Israel started a new chapter by targeting Palestinian economy. So many businesses, so many factories have been destroyed and damaged. In addition to that, you mentioned that Israeli attacks on clinics, also especially those providing COVID-19 services and vaccinations, when Gaza is plagued by COVID-19. Israel is also damaging and targeting Palestinian schools. So this is a total destruction from the Israeli occupation against the native Palestinians in Gaza.
Can you describe what the past hours, the days have been like for your family, Rafat? And we are speaking to you on the phone versus through video Skype. You are having a lot of trouble with electricity.
Exactly. Israel is preventing the fuel to get to the Seoul power plant in Gaza, and also targeting facilities that, which means that we will have less electricity. We have very slow internet connection now because Israel wants a total blackout. The most important thing that could summarize this is that every single night here in Gaza, we say this is the worst night of our lives. And every night Israel proves us wrong because it comes with more monstrosity. It comes with more bombardment, more missiles raining on Palestinian heads. Last night was a horrific night that Israel also chooses the timing when kids are asleep or about to sleep or have just slept and starts the bombardment campaign in order to maximize the damage, maximize the trauma, and maximize the terror. You mentioned the two nights ago, Israel leveled a whole neighborhood, destroying blocks of homes, whole families were massacred. Al-Kolak family had almost 20 family members massacred by Israeli warplanes as they slept, as they huddled in the safety of their homes.
You wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times. My child asks, can Israel destroy our building if the power is out? Talk more about, you have 6 children?
Yeah, I do, yeah. The thing is that, again, what makes this far worse than anything is that this is not new. This is a continuation of Israeli aggression against Palestinians that started in 1948, the Nakba you just mentioned. Israel is particularly trying to destroy our young generation, especially the children. Out of the 200 people Israel massacred in 6 days, 60 are children, almost 40 are women, about 20 are elderly people. So this is an open war against the vulnerable, the sick. The kids are suffering the most. A friend of mine told me the other day that the worst case scenario for us is to survive this brutal war by Israel, because the trauma, especially with the kids, is not going to be an easy thing to deal with, is not going to be something that can fix by just Israel ending this aggression. There has to be a radical solution to end the aggression and the brutal Israeli racist apartheid regime.
You write that your daughter, who is 8 years old, or in Gazan time, 2 wars old, asked sheepishly if, quote, they could still destroy a building now that the power was out. Can you talk more about how your children, you're keeping your children safe, what it means to go outside, Rafat?
We never go outside. I just went outside with my son to run some errands, and it's very dangerous. We took our COVID masks off because we didn't want to be targeted for people trying to hide. I asked my son, I told him, Omar, do you want to walk together or far away from each other? He looked at me and said, what difference does it make? Because he knows when Israel throws these bombs, it destroys. So the kids cannot go out. They are always huddled in. We try to keep them in the safest place in the home, but there is no safety when Israel throws bombs that are 5 or 6 or 7 tons on the same building. The kids are horrified. They wake up shrieking. They wake up crying, and they're shaking. Even when the door slams, the kids would fidget and think that this is some kind of Israeli bomb nearby. The trauma is unprecedented. It will never go away. I hope it will go away. But with the kids, we try to keep them close to us. We tell them stories. Something new I saw from my 2 little daughters, Lena and Amal, is that they started building houses. Usually they play dolls. The past 2 nights, they used their dolls and cubes to build high-rising buildings and homes. And this is really heartbreaking because it seems that they are aware that Israel is destroying homes. And these very children are trying to build even with toys. And finally, when it comes to this, I want to emphasize a point. Israel has trying to destroy the Palestinian children, Palestinian youth, for decades and decades. In the first Intifada, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, 60 years ago. But every time the next generation grows fiercer and more determined to be free, more determined to be part of the global struggle for freedom, because Israel is a racist colonial regime that is bombing, besieging, and destroying native people who have very little means to resist.
On Saturday, President Biden spoke with both the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Palestinian National Authority President, Mahmoud Abbas. According to the White House, in his conversation with Netanyahu, Biden, quote, reaffirmed his strong support for Israel's right to defend itself against rocket attacks from Hamas and other terrorist groups in Gaza, unquote. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff Sunday urged the Biden administration to push harder for a ceasefire. In an interview with CBS's Face the Nation, Schiff was asked if he believed Israeli attacks on Palestine were disproportionate in comparison to attacks from Hamas against Israel. This was his response.
Every rocket that Hamas sends into Israel is a deliberate effort to kill civilians, and I think we need to understand that these rockets are indiscriminate and by definition designed to kill civilians. Israel has the right to defend itself, but has to use every effort to avoid civilian casualties. Now, I think they are trying, but nonetheless, the death toll increases and the violence has got to stop. And I think we need to do everything possible to bring about a ceasefire. I think the administration needs to push harder on Israel and the Palestinian Authority to stop the violence, bring about a ceasefire and these hostilities, and get back to a process of trying to resolve this long-standing conflict.
So that's Adam Schiff. And of course, we've heard what Biden said and also his conversation with Netanyahu on the phone. But then you have progressive Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is saying apartheid states are not democracies. Rafat Elarir, what do you say to President Biden?
I think it was Biden that gave Netanyahu the green light to start this. When they tweeted that America supports Israel's right to defend itself 2 days after the aggression started, I quickly said that this is going to be a long war against civilians because Israel is killing us using American weapons, using American technology, using American planes. America has, the American administration, all American administrations have blood, Palestinian blood on their hands. The massacre that is going on is on Biden. And it's very shame to see people like Adam Schiff and those people who were fierce rivals to Trump and his barbarity say things like Israel has the right to defend itself. There is no moral equivalence here. Israel is an occupying power. The aggressor and Palestinians are the oppressed native people defending themselves with what little means they have. But sadly, it seems that both the Democrats and the Republicans unite fiercely to enable Israel, to empower Israel, because both countries were born in genocide and continue to ethnically cleanse natives and oppress them. As for AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and other amazing Black caucus and the wonderful solidarity in America with Jewish Voice for Peace, Indigenous peoples, and Black Lives Matter activists. This shows how this Israel's lies and fabrications are no longer dominant. People stopped fearing Israel. They now can see that Israel is brutal, that Israel is apartheid, and this amazing and wonderful solidarity with the Palestinian struggle is something that means a lot to us. We learn from these people, and we are part of this global struggle, and we hope this is going to increase more and more to create real pressure to stop America from arming Israel, empowering Israel to kill Palestinians.
Rafat Elarir, please stay safe. Palestinian academic and activist, we hear your children in the background. Editor of the book Gaza Writes Back and co-editor of Gaza Unsilenced. We'll link to your op-ed piece in the New York Times headlined, "My Child Asks, Can Israel Destroy Our Building If the Power Is Out?" We will soon be speaking with the head of B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights group. But next up, we stay in Gaza City and talk to the director of operations in Gaza for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. Stay with us. Mal Vamukata. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. You can sign up for our daily News Digest email by texting Democracy Now! One word, no space, to 66866. We'll send you our news headlines and stories every day, as well as news alerts. At least 10 Palestinians from the same extended family died Saturday when Israel bombed the Gaza refugee camp Al-Shati. 8 of the victims were children. One 5-month-old baby named Omar was pulled from the rubble alive. His mother and 4 of his siblings were killed. This is Omar's father, Mohammed Al-Hadidi.
They targeted the house they were in. There were no rockets there, just women and children. No rockets, just peaceful children celebrating Eid. What have they done to deserve this? A rocket hit their house, over their heads, without warning or communication. 3 whole floors fell over them, and we had to recover their body parts. I call on the international community, those who support human rights and children's rights and democracy, those who penalize anyone who harms a child, to look to our children here who are being bombed with strikes that drop entire floors onto people who we have to recover their body parts.
We're joined now in Gaza by Matthias Schmalle, the Director of Operations for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Can you talk about what happened not only there, but what's happening to children, to the Palestinians in Gaza?
Good afternoon, Amy, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk to you. Look, the way I describe this is we've had 7 days of war. This is war. We're not close to war. We're not in a military confrontation. This is war. And I think, as you just heard from Rafa, the citizens of Gaza are experiencing this in a terrified manner. It's terror from the skies, what's going on here. And you mentioned the house that was leveled in Beach Camp, our refugee camp. 6 of those children were children that went to UNRWA schools. So it hits home very directly. Some of my staff knew the family. And these 6 children are among 18 children that we now have confirmed that went to UNRWA schools. So what I am trying to get to with all of this is the price the civilian population is paying for this is unacceptable. This has to stop. This is terror on a civilian population. We also have to then think about the people who have fled their homes out of fear. A few nights ago, there was heavy fighting in the north. There were rumors of a ground invasion by the Israelis, and thousands of people left their homes in fear, not necessarily because they were destroyed, as I understand it. I will come back to that, but in fear of what will fall from the sky next. And we now have today, 3 days later or so, 41,000 and more people in 50 of our schools. Fortunately, the population, remembering also 2014, sees the blue of the United Nations and buildings that have a blue UN flag on it as still a relatively safe place, safer than their own home. So that is what is happening. As UNRWA, we are trying our best to stand up our teams that will manage these centers properly and provide the necessary assistance. There are some immediate needs like protection, including protection from COVID. Of course, COVID is far from over, as well as safe water, the basic needs you need to have covered if you are in a shelter away from home. Then you've also talked about people who've actually lost their home. The last I heard is that at least 600 families are not able to go back. So many of the people who are at the moment in our shelters could go back if there is a ceasefire, but there is a group of at least 600 families and households that couldn't, because either their house is totally destroyed or it's too damaged to go back. And, you know, allow me to make a point there. The Israelis claim, and correctly on this point, that they often warn. They don't always. Like the beach camp hit was without warning, as far as I know. But they have warned on other high-rise buildings civilians to get out. So in those terms, they protect their lives. But they have lost their homes. They are now without a home. And it's completely senseless and mind-boggling. So that is the situation on the ground. I cannot, as eloquently, of course, as Rafa described, the impact on the civilian population. He is directly affected. I can only say to you, I hear a lot about traumas. One of my colleagues texted me very movingly saying, as a family, they now sleep on the same mattress in the central part of their home just because they want to die together if that happens.
Matthias, you talked about people responding to a rumor that Israel's invading, but this was not just a rumor. Israel, the military, directly put that out. The headlines of the New York Times, a press corps deceived and the Gaza invasion that wasn't. The Washington Post, Israel told the media it had ground forces in Gaza, then it changed the story. AP, Israeli military accused of using media to trick Hamas. You're talking about the human toll of that trick. Can you explain further the significance of them putting this out and tens of thousands of Palestinians fleeing?
Yeah, I mean, I can only say if they indeed, they being the military on the Israeli side, put this out deliberately without really having the intention, that is just atrocious, you know, and unacceptable, because as you have said, it led to then thousands of people fleeing. And by the way, we only know about the 41,000 that are seeking refuge, a safe place to be in our schools. There are many thousands more that went to family and relatives. So there's another disaster in the making here, because a lot of poor families are having to host people, you know, being themselves squeezed. So we're looking into how we can assist them. It's reckless. It's shameless and reckless how the military is operating in terms of the civilian population.
Can you give us some specific stories of children killed? I ask that because when the Israeli military was asked about this yesterday, they said, consider the source of the information you're getting about the number of Palestinian children who are dead. They said it is the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, which is run by Hamas. So they said, consider the source. So, Matthias Schmala, you are with the United Nations. Talk about the number of Palestinian children who have died.
So, Amy, if I may say two things on this. We have our independent source. We run 278 schools, which are populated by 285,000 children. We have very precise information about this school population, the 285,000 children. This is independent information from the Ministry of Health and the authorities here. When I tell you, my health teams have reported to me that they know at least 18 of the more than 50 children killed were UNRWA school children. So there is no doubt in my mind this is correct, independently verified information, and I would not be surprised if, sadly, that number of 18 were to rise quite significantly. So that's one bit. The other bit is I was told very movingly by one of our so-called area education officers about a 13-year-old child, one of the 18, by the name of Hamza. His mother is severely disabled. His father has died. Hamza is the person who looks after the family. And he was out shopping to get the basic needs covered for the family. And on his way back, he happened to be in the wrong place when a missile hit. So a young child leaves the home to bring food for his family and returns dead. These are not made up stories. This is not Hamas stories or anyone spinning a story. This is real life story. The human cost of this is unbearable and unacceptable.
We are not only talking about the Israeli assault on Gaza, but we are talking about the pandemic. Israel has been hailed as being the gold standard of ensuring its population is vaccinated, has not been the case for what has happened in the occupied territories, which they are responsible for. During the pandemic, UNRWA has been working to ensure access to PPE and water. Can you talk about clean water? Can you talk talk now about this report we shared at the beginning, the number of doctors who've been killed in the Israeli airstrikes, including Dr. Ayman Abulaluf, maybe you know him, who headed the coronavirus response at Shifa Hospital, the main hospital in Gaza. Another prominent doctor from Shifa, the neurologist, Muin Ahmad Al-Alul, also killed in an airstrike. And what this means for Gaza?
Yeah, I did not know those two individuals you named personally. I know of them. And again, you know, all the information I've had about them, I've been here now 3.5 years. So I think I have a pretty good sense of, you know, who is linked to the authorities and in reality a militant and who is not, who is just simply doing their job. And to the best of my knowledge, these two doctors who were killed were professionals trying to provide health care and address immediate and urgent health needs of the population here. So indeed, one of the issues when there is a war is to protect health institutions and healthcare workers, including doctors. And the toll in those terms is also rising. You mentioned, I think, at the beginning, the MSF clinic that was destroyed. I also know from my colleagues in the Palestinian Red Crescent that their central ambulance unit was severely affected. One of our 22 primary healthcare centers, in fact, was not targeted but had some damage as a result of a strike that was too close. So when we are still fighting the COVID-19 crisis, we were just seeing the beginning of the end of the second wave. We should also remember that we, just before Corona started a year plus ago, we were coming out of 2 years of great marches of return, which had a devastating human impact. There were more than 35,000 people injured at the fence, as they call it here, more than 200 killed, again, including 13 UNRWA school children due to disproportionate reaction from the Israeli side. And I'm mentioning this because the health system was already struggling and basically on its knees. We were very worried that COVID would be the cause of the health system falling apart. It barely coped. And now this on top of it. So this war, if it continues any longer, has the risk of having a very decimating, devastating impact on healthcare, on its people, in terms of the doctors and nurses, and on the healthcare infrastructure.
Finally, Matthias Schmaler, you grew up in South Africa. I'm wondering your thoughts on the comparison of occupied Palestine to apartheid. Our next group, B'Tselem, uses that term. Human Rights Watch uses that term. Of course, many Palestinians talk about that. Do you think that is a fair comparison?
Speaking here as an individual who grew up in apartheid South Africa, I have to tell you, what I'm experiencing here reminds me a lot of what I saw in my childhood. The issue is people being treated, an entire people being treated differently from the rest of us, you know, and whether that fits some academic definition of apartheid or not, it is wrong. And these are an occupied people that this should stop. You know, not just the war has to stop. There has to be the beginning of a meaningful process, as we did see in South Africa that ended the system there, that has as its aim a just solution for what happened 70 or so years ago during what the Palestinians called the Nakba, and that provides the opportunity for everyone, and that, of course, includes Israelis, to live a dignified and peaceful existence next to each other or together.
Matthias Schmaler, we want to thank you for being with us, director of UNRWA operations in Gaza. That's the UN agency that works with Palestinians. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak to a reporter who works with Al Jazeera and AP. The media building that housed AP and Al Jazeera has just been bombed by the Israeli military this weekend. We'll talk about what this means for getting access to information out of Gaza. Stay with us.
This girl I know needs some shelter, but she don't believe anyone can help her. She's doing so much harm, doing so much damage, but you don't want to get involved. You tell her she can't.
destruction by massive attack. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday, Israel leveled a 12-story building housing the offices of Associated Press, Al Jazeera, and other media outlets. Israel justified the bombing, claiming Hamas uses the building, but offered no proof. Earlier today, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken said he has not seen any Israeli evidence of Hamas operating in the building. While Israel gave advance notice of the attack, the head of Al Jazeera called the attack a blatant violation of human rights and war crime. Associated Press is demanding an independent investigation. They said they know of no evidence of Hamas operating in the building. Yumna Al-Sayed is a reporter for the Associated Press in the Gaza Strip. She's been covering Israel's attack on Gaza over the past week. Can you work with Al Jazeera as well? Talk about what happened to the building. Talk about where you work.
Hi. Yes, I'm Yumna Al-Sayed. I'm a reporter at the Associated Press, and I broadcast for Al Jazeera from Associated Press. While we were at the building on a normal day of work, reporting the aggression that is happening on the Gaza Strip, we suddenly got a call by the owner of the building saying that he was called by the Israeli army, and he's been asked to tell the residents of the building to immediately evacuate. In an hour, the building shall be targeted. So this was an emergency situation for us. Everyone was frightened of what is going on and what is going to happen. Usually when we get such calls of other buildings that we have seen, there is, in 15 minutes, there is a targeting by a warning missile that is close to the building or in an empty apartment in the building. And that is what we were afraid of. In exactly 15 minutes, the first missile, warning missile, had been targeted next to the building. It was really traumatizing for all of us running around on the stairs. The building is out of 12 stories, and the first five floors were offices that host doctors' offices and lawyers' offices, Palestinian labs. And the other six floors are residential apartments. And the last floor is the floor that hosts the Associated Press and opposite to it, Al Jazeera office. So basically, this building is one of the most famous buildings in the Strip. It is, all the residents know each other. The doctors' offices are known. The lawyers' offices there are known. No stranger comes in or out of that building. And that's why, the side of the story that says that there is a Hamas intelligence that was in that building, and that's why they targeted their building, has to do nothing with the reality of targeting the third building that hosts media offices in the Gaza Strip. After just a couple of days, Al-Sharuq Tower and Al-Jawhariya Tower, the largest two buildings that host all the media offices in the Gaza Strip, were completely destructed and go to the ground. This was just the third one, but it had international media offices, and it was one of the safest places ever.
So you all have moved in with Agence France-Presse, who has offered their offices for you to try to safely operate?
We are operating from different places now, a Shifa complex. We weren't able to take a lot of what we had in the office. I mean, very few cameras, one or two, very few of our equipment we were able to save. Some of us were just on the stairs trying to help the civilians with their children to evacuate the building. It was really frightening, and it was really we were really in a hurry, especially after the targeting of the reconnaissance warning missile that just targeted next to us. Another one was targeted 15 minutes later. So in half an hour, we had two missiles, warning missiles. That itself, in 30 minutes, almost all the building was evacuated, because we were very much frightened that it could be targeted or destructed in less than an hour. We asked the Israeli army spokesman for just 30 minutes. We asked him for 30 minutes when he called again, and we said we just need 30 minutes to get a little bit of our equipment from the offices. The residents needed to get some little necessities or essentials from their apartments, but he totally refused. And right after that, the targeting began, and the tower was all brought to the ground. So now we're just shattered here and there, trying to work from different locations with very little resources and little equipment that we have.
Can you describe more also what happened this morning just as you were driving in Gaza, the targeted attack on a car in front of you?
Yes, I was going to Shifa Complex where I broadcast for Al Jazeera, and just 10 meters away, like 10 meters away, a car got targeted in front of us. And honestly, if my driver hadn't lowered the speed just like 30 seconds because his phone rang, so he had to lower the speed just 30 seconds away, we would have been in that targeting as well. We would have died in that targeting as well. So, like, you would be going out for work. I leave my family, I say goodbye to them, and I go to work, and I know that I might actually get targeted or killed at any instant. That itself is something that is really, really traumatizing and heavy to carry around. I mean, I had to go on air after that, but I wasn't even able to express what I have been through. I mean, this aggression might end any day, but the trauma that it has caused to each one of us is going to stay for so long with us.
Yumna, you have 4 children?
Yes.
What do you tell them?
I have 4 children. The youngest is 2.5 years, and the oldest is 10 years.
What do you tell them?
I tell them to forgive me. I tell them to forgive me if anything happens to me and I have to leave them, because this is my duty, and I have to deliver this message to the world. I know that there's nothing that forces me to go out and report in such times, but I have to do this, because if I don't do it in these hard times, if I don't deliver the message now, then when am I going to do that?
The destruction
around us is massive.
What do you think the message is that was delivered to the media by this attack on the main media offices, Al Jazeera, NAP, where you work, other media organizations? Now Tony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying he was not told of any direct evidence of Hamas working in this building.
Yes, and I'm sure that there isn't going to be any. I mean, the Israeli army, when it has the proof for anything to back its story, it provides it at once, instantly. I mean, it wants to back its story. It has to, okay? But in it's not a coincidence that 3 towers hosting media offices would be completely destructed. This is no coincidence. I mean, this is just a deliberate targeting to the media voice in the Gaza Strip.
Yumna Al-Sayed, I want to turn to video of you last week when you were live on the air when Israel leveled another high-rise building in Gaza.
I'm sending a message to the world. Please, before you judge us, before you say that we are terrorists, I want you to make sure that you see the reality and the truth from all sides. Do not just take the Western media and go with it. Do not believe the Israeli messages and the Israeli side of the story without seeing our side. As you can see now, the building has been brought down. It has been fully destructed. This is a tower. This is a Shuruq tower, a 14-story building that has been brought to the ground, totally distracted by air raids. By the way, just for you to know, this tower is in a very densely populated.
That's Yumna Al-Sayed reporting last week for Al Jazeera in the Gaza Strip. Now, the building she worked out of, Associated Press and Al Jazeera, has also been bombed by the Israeli military. For our radio listeners, what you can't see, Yumna's wearing a helmet. When that explosion happened, she ducks down. Can you describe where you were then? Was that the building that has now been destroyed, or is that another building, Yumna?
Yes, that was the building where we had our offices, the AP and Al Jazeera. And that is where I usually broadcast for Al Jazeera, from the rooftop of that building. That is the building that has been targeted. And the building that was targeted behind me in the video is the Shuruq building, which is a 14-story building that hosts three quarters of the media offices in the Gaza Strip. It's the second largest and hosts all the media, like all, most of the media offices in the Gaza Strip.
Finally, this false report that was put out by the Israeli military that there was a ground assault taking place in Gaza, using the media to convey that message. Actually, Associated Press did a breakdown of this and would not report it directly, but all the other press, and now headlines in the New York Times and Washington Post about the media being tricked. What happened, Yumna?
Well, if you're talking about, I'm sorry, you're talking about the media where I was?
The media being, the Israeli military putting out that they were doing a ground assault of Gaza and the Western media reporting that.
Yes. I think that that was, if you're going to ask me as Yumna, not just a reporter, I will tell you that this was a kind of a way for the Israeli army to play with the feelings and emotions of the citizens in the Gaza Strip, just to put more pressure on them. I mean, everyone was extremely traumatized when they heard that there is going to be a ground operation taking place alongside with the air operation that is already taking place and causing great crisis here in the Gaza Strip. And then suddenly there's nothing, and they start saying that, no, it's not true. We're not going to carry on a land operation. So I think it was an attempt to actually try to bring down traumatize the people of the Strip even more.
Well, Yumna Al-Sayed, I want to thank you for being with us. A journalist in the Gaza Strip with the Associated Press and Al Jazeera, worked in the building that housed AP and Al Jazeera that was bombed by the Israeli military. Yumna has four children. We will bring you our interview with B'Tselem at democracynow.org and on the show tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.